I'm Sonia Morton Firth, and you're tuned in to the Sonia Morton Firth Show. Today, my guest is Eric Kleinsmith. Eric served in the US military intelligence and is an expert on terrorism. He's also an author and now vice president for the American Military University for Strategic Relations in Intelligence and Cybersecurity. We talk about him being a whistleblower in the US investigation of 9/11 and the infamous legend D.B. Cooper. We also talk about COVID, the manipulation of data, censorship, and what the biggest threat is to the US today. Thank you so much for agreeing to be a guest on my show. Now, I'm loving this because I get to interview people all around the world. So that's the positive about doing the Zoom. Eric, tell everyone where you're from and where you're sitting at the moment.
Okay, well, I'm actually sitting in my house because, and I work for an online university called American Military University, or there's other names for it, American Public University System, but our school has always been an online or distance learning higher education. So, I even got my master's through the school and in strategic intelligence while I was in active duty working in a classified environment. That was the beauty of the school. So when I eventually finally came to work for them, we did have an office in Manassas, Virginia, which is right out and right next to the Manassas battlefield from the American Civil War. So you can walk out of the building and you're on an area of the battlefield, which is, as a history nerd, it's fantastic for me. But just for COVID, we decided to shut that building down. And so everybody's works from home. So I'm in my undisclosed location, AKA my basement, my house. I told my wife, it's like, hey, I'm going to be working from home. And she goes, well, how long? I said, for the rest of my career. And she said, well, then you're moving out of the dining room.
Here's the basement. There you
exactly.
go. Exactly. Eric, look, I'm so thrilled that you're with me here today. I'm very excited about our chat. Now, before we get into sort of some of the ins and outs of your career, you joined the military. Tell me a little bit more about that background. Why did you decide to join the military?
Well, part of it is I am the youngest of three boys. My dad was an educator. My mom was an educator. But my father was killed when I was 15. And it was just as simple. He was jogging around outside of our neighborhood, and a girl that was putting makeup on hit him from behind. As a distracted driver. And so that was in the middle of in between my sophomore and junior year of high school. So my high school was, as privileged as I felt being raised with a fantastic father, fantastic mother. And my father never joined a group or club that did not have to do with the family. So he was never involved with the local Rotary or any kind of lodge or anything like that. And for criticism that we received from that, it was his response was, you're not contributing to the community. And he said, well, I'm raising three boys. That's my contribution to the community. Mm-hmm. And after he passed away, we all had, we were all growing up in a very patriotic environment in terms of our family. So my oldest brother became an officer in the Marine Corps. My middle brother became an officer in the Army and joined the 101st Airborne Division. And then he had since left, and he just retired December 31st after 30 years as a Secret Service officer. He's probably one of the most decorated officers in the history of that organization. So it's just patriotism has always been part of our life. And so part of, besides the patriotic feel, but also to understand more about my father's life is another reason why I think we all joined up. And so I joined the military first as an armor officer, which was perfect because my dad was an armored cavalry officer. He was in the Cold War. He was on the German border in the 7th Cavalry for a time. So that was a big draw for me. So I did my first tour on M1 tanks. And then I switched over to these scouts and reconnaissance vehicles. And so we were doing in the UK, it would be a version of the Rat Patrol from World War II, where we had 10 Humvees, no tops, no doors, no windshields. which would be fantastic in the desert, but we were in the mountains of Colorado, and it was much harder living when you spend a third of your year out in the field for that. And then from that point, I switched over to intelligence, and that was the rest of my career.
And that's obviously where I want to chat to you about your career in the intelligence side of it. You became chief of intelligence for land information warfare. And as I understand it, you pioneered analysis using data mining. Now, for some people, that might go over their head a little bit.
Yeah.
Translate that into plain layman terms, English terms.
Okay.
What were you actually doing?
This was a relatively brand new organization. It had only been in existence for, I think, 2 years before I even arrived. And the organization was focused on all of the elements of information warfare. So that includes deception, psychological operations, computer network defense or computer network attack, those kind of aspects. And then it even got into what term was called operational security. So when you're working as a business or something like that, how much of the secrets of your business are you throwing in the trash? And somebody can just dive into a dumpster and find out everything your company is working on, whether it's a secret sauce or the next plans for the next auto, next vehicle that you're designing or something like that. And so that was another aspect of going into organizations and, and just showing them, here's where you're losing all of your information. We can, anybody who is a spy doesn't need to break into your organization. You're throwing it out, or your folks are talking about it online or something like that. And that's another aspect. And so all these parts of information warfare, I became the first military lead as an Army major of the intelligence branch for that. And so it was our job to do analysis. And what really what an intelligence does, and if you think about an intelligence and as an police investigator that does analysis, a police investigator does analysis to try to figure out what happened. How did the crime occur? So they're doing it working in the past.
Yeah.
What intelligence folks have to do is they're working with the same information, but it's their job to say, this is what I think is going to happen in the future based upon, whatever threat organization you're worked on. And oh, by the way, they don't want us to know what they're working on. So they're taking their own measures to hide information and things like that. And that's really the business of intelligence overall.
And on that, you worked on many high profile cases.
Yes.
And as you just mentioned, you were looking into the future rather than sort of investigating the past.
Right, right.
Tell me about the ABLE Danger Program, because that's the one that I guess, had you known what was going to happen.
Right.
Obviously the consequences of that were devastating.
Right.
Tell me a little bit more about what ABLE Danger was all about.
Okay. ABLE Danger was the name to an operation that the U.S. Special Operations Command embarked on after the bombings of Kenya and Tanzania, the U.S. embassies there. And they came to us afterwards, and they were looking for a way to find and hunt down Al-Qaeda worldwide. But they were fairly unhappy with the results they were getting from the big three-letter agencies around D.C., the CIA.
And just to be clear, this was before 9/11. We're talking.
Yes, this was 1999, 2000, and they came to our organization just on the tail end of their kind of fact hunting trip of who could help them. And the problem with the large intelligence agencies is they're not designed at the time. They weren't designed to help a bunch of war fighters. They're really designed to help national decision makers. That's what they were there for. And so when an organization comes to them and says, look, we need some help hunting these guys, it was really, well, we can help you, but you got to take a number. And that's a very simple way of saying it. And so they came to us, and they saw that we were the first operation that had brought in data mining tools. The first 6 months of my job there was trying to figure these tools out, because there was no class, there was no book, there was no guide on doing that. And so it was myself and my analyst trying to figure out how to make sense of all the data that we could then harvest and visualize through different software tools or whatever.
What sort of data are we talking about here?
It could be anything from at the front end of an operation. You're always going to use what is really called open source, which is just newspapers, web articles, things like that. That's open to everyone, publicly available information. And that can be about 85% of what you need is out there in the public already. Problem is there's so much of it. And so we had, for example, we had a tool that we could just use a query, like a Google query or something like that. But instead of just seeing pages and pages of links that we'd go to, we had a tool that could harvest all of those links and then throw them into a chart so that you would see 4,000 articles at one time, but they were all laid out in a topographical map according to the subject matter. And that's where your tactical sense comes in. You start looking at the high points, you're looking at the isolated nodes, and why did somebody write about this and nobody else wrote about that? You know, why did this keyword come up so many times? And what we also realized that we could easily pick up propaganda. So when somebody was running an operation, a propaganda operation against our country, and in one case where you were using a foreign election, we could see the threat country that did not like us was constantly using the same phrase. Let's say it's gravitas or whatever. We could see it where it started. We could see how that talking point spread. We could see where, you know, when it reached its peak or when it died off. So there's all these new things that we could do with information. Wow. And it's really what we briefed the special operation guys, and then they were immediately sold. It's like, we want you guys as part of this operation.
And at what point do you sort of look at all this and think, wow, there's something going on here? It's not looking good, or this is looking like something's gonna proceed. Hmm.
For Able Danger, that was almost immediate, because we had already done previously, and that's how they knew about us, is we were already doing another operation to understand how Chinese foreign intelligence was stealing technology from the Department of Defense. Which is just shocking what we were revealing and what we were learning. It's just, you know, it is so easy to steal technology if you can steal it in the places that they're doing the research before it becomes classified technology. And that was a big shock. So we were seeing a total infiltration of our university system, our graduate labs, our research labs, and then total infiltration of multinational corporations that we would have partnerships, but that corporation would also had a partnership with a Chinese firm or something like that. And so we would already gain notoriety for revealing all of these vulnerabilities in our own system. And that's what brought special operations guys to us. And so as soon as we started doing data mining harvesting, and it was just like, take the word Al-Qaeda, go, and just start with that. And we started getting hits. We had to organize them geographically. And where it really hit me when I saw my hometown of Plymouth, Michigan popped up as a node for a link to a false front business that was funneling money into the Al-Qaeda organization. And that was just the total eye opener right there. And that was like on the third day of us working this. And so we immediately found the footprints in Europe. We found footprints in the South Pacific, a partner organization called Jamaah Islamiyah, and Abu Sayyaf working in the Philippines and Indonesia. But really, what really got to us was when we started seeing, you know, we found the New Jersey cell, we found Muhammad Atta and his co-pilots involved in the flight classes. We saw a heavy presence in Canada, and we learned very quickly that to a foreign terrorist organization like Al-Qaeda, Canada was their aircraft carrier to attack us, you know, and so immediately started losing still sleep over that.
And Eric, you found out all of this before 9/11.
Right.
Happened? We were alert. What happened to the program?
We were working in close partnership with Special Operations Command, but the word got started filtering up through the chain of command and got into the Pentagon that here was this here was this small intelligence operation. It was only 24 of us. In fact, the team that I put together for this was only 4 people, including myself.
Were you worried for your own life at this stage? The sort of information that you were.
Yes, yes, but not as much as we got more paranoid with the Chinese foreign intel because of the reach of their organization. But what we started getting was a feel of dread that something was coming, and we weren't, you know, we couldn't nail down specifically what it was. We just knew something was coming, and so. Years later, I had to go testify before the U.S. Yeah. Senate and U.S. House Armed Service Committee, and I had to finally draw on the analogy that we felt like afterwards that we were the radio listening station that was positioned on the north coast of Hawaii, watching the Japanese fighters stream toward Pearl Harbor, and being unable to really get our voice out that this was coming. And so we sent information back to SOCOM. We were working with them, but the DOD lawyers and leadership started getting more and more upset with the fact that we were harvesting so much information, but we were also in these batches of 2.5 terabytes that we were pulling in. We were also pulling in information about US persons, and it's specifically illegal for intelligence folks to collect on US persons as part of our own US code or our own laws. And the problem that they were wrestling with was, well, did these guys do that on purpose, or was it just incidental because they put in a phrase and that's what came back? And they shut the whole operation down, but it took months for them to wrestle with how do we do this properly? The frustration was that we could only, besides collecting the information, if there was information on US persons, which we undoubtedly had, we could also only keep that information for 90 days. So as the 90-day mark hit, I was informed by our own lawyers that had come down and said, you know, look, you either delete this stuff or you go to jail. And so I was the one who deleted all the data, and I had a warrant officer with me, and she deleted our secondary set of data. And that was about the worst day I think I've ever had in the military, was doing that, because we knew something was coming and we were shutting everything down. And we were deleting everything we had.
Wow, Eric. I mean, I'm sure you've had many sleepless nights over it. So you basically deleted evidence that 9/11 right. was going to take place.
Right.
But you were made to delete. You didn't.
Right. Right. And I got grilled on it up on Capitol Hill before the Senate, and one of the President Biden, when he was a senator, he was in there. And that was the questions it got back is, you know, why, you know, who made you delete this data? I said, nobody did this. And I held up the regulation. The regulation made me delete the data. But what was horrible about that whole day was, as I got into the room, it was packed, wall-to-wall folks of myself going to testify. And I was asking one of the staffers, like, who are all these folks that are here? He said, well, about a third of them are reporters. About a third of them are other staffers. And about a third of them are the families of the victims of 9/11.
Wow.
And that just, at that point, that was again, another low point where it's just, you know, I have to walk in and tell the world why I failed.
Wow.
By obeying the law.
And that's what you swore to. But in the same light, you became a whistleblower, right? You didn't.
Yes.
You didn't have to stand up and say this. And I bet the easier thing would have been, not the easier thing, but you were telling a nation what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That must have entailed a huge amount of, well, risk. And you to actually stand up and say those things.
Right. It was frustrating because, yes, I could have held the data, but knowing so would have knowingly violated our own regulations. And quite frankly, put our own unit in jeopardy. Somebody else would have come down and deleted it for me, and, you know, we would have suffered the consequences for not doing that or trying to hide it or whatever. And I think it was just one of those instances where, you know, you do everything in your power for your entire career to further your own country and you know, follow your own guides of what you think is right and wrong. And you're doing something that you know in your heart is completely wrong, but it's in conflict with what you know you're supposed to be doing.
Would you have done it differently?
I
guess that's a very
it's hard to do. Now it's after 9/11, like the entire world has changed. So it's just the second time I went up, I had to testify. It was 6 months later, we had to go back up. And I had, after the testimony was all done, I had reporters asking questions. And I had this guy was asking me all these questions, follow me out in the hallway, asking me some very personal stuff. And I finally just had to stop this guy. And I said, look, I'm sorry, I don't know who you are. And he said, I am so sorry. My name is Kirk Lippold. I was the commander of the USS Cole that was bombed. And we had intelligence that could also have warned his ship that there was a planned attack on that as well, because that was part of the data set that we had deleted, because we also had some residual pieces on other operations, and everyone had known that as well. And I just, again, the first thing I had to do was again, apologize to him. I was like, I am sorry I failed you. And because of that, 17 sailors lost their lives. If we could have warned you, we could have prevented that. I mean, now we're friends, but it's just, you know, another tough part.
So in the end of the day, you were basically taking orders. You were doing
what? Yes.
Did anyone pay for this? Were rules changed?
No. 9/11 Commission skipped over. It never came down to even interview us. And part of the reason was because they didn't know we existed. We didn't know our operation was being run like that. It was one of our members who finally blew the whistle, and we had to make a choice. So when he first came out, we had to make a choice. Do we back this guy or do we tell, go back and tell the truth and the details? And this guy was our liaison to a DIA. In fact, you probably know him. His name is Tony Schaefer. He's a regular pundit on several shows. But that that was our decision. Do we back him up or do we not? And my immediately, it's just like this story of what we tried to do. And the whole argument is, well, the U.S. failed because they failed to connect the dots. My answer to that is absolutely not. We connected the dots.
You didn't.
We failed because we failed ourselves because of our own bureaucracy and our own inability to get past some of our parochial interests of agencies protecting information from other agencies and things like that.
Now, I think I might know the answer to this, but would this happen again? Like, let's say this whole scenario now.
There is always the biggest shock that I know folks are worried about now is the term called the cyber Pearl Harbor, and it's not just a cyber attack, but could there be an attack that's a multi-layered attack, because you could do, there's lots of literature, fictitious novels, folks writing about this, but how could you combine a total breakdown of the U.S. society by a terrorist attack with an EMP strike with a cyber attack that just disrupts everything that we've been involved with? And that's your doomsday scenario, which would involve millions of lives and things like that. That's really why cyber has become such an important piece for our U.S. national security, or even U.K. national security.
I mean, just on that, because things in the U.S., I mean, we're going through difficult times all around the world.
Right.
And I guess we can't not mention the COVID word.
Right.
Now, I'm not quite sure how things are there. We're looking positive. It looks like we're coming out of lockdown. But obviously, it's shaken up the world. What are your views on that? Because I believe you've written some articles. China. And it'd be interesting to hear those. You've probably been asked this 1,000 times.
Right. Part of with COVID, and it was interesting because my daughter caught it, and she was down at a school, James Madison University, which is about 100 miles from here. At her age, it was the worst thing that happened was the effect on her social life, with some of her friends blaming her for getting it and things like that. But from a 20-year-old, she just, she was able just to bear through it and just shook it off within a week or so. But for a country at large, I think the worst piece about what it did to our economy and our livelihoods and our culture and everything else is that the virus didn't do that. We did that. You know, we destroyed our own economy. We changed our own culture. And part of it was based upon, and the some of the talks I gave initially on COVID was really based upon the false sets of modeling that occurred to try to, and again, if you're involved with information warfare, you know, people create models, liars figures and figures lie. And so I see in models that were coming out that were total exaggerations and fabrications. And one of the things, like one example, is there's a photo that was floating around my social media, and it's a photo of an intersection, but somebody had blown up a COVID virus to the size of a watermelon size virus, and then just put it all over the photo and up on the street lamps, and the caption was, if you could see it, would you still go out? And I'm looking at this, it's like, this is such an exaggeration it's a model. I am almost certain that a COVID virus is not sitting on a stoplight waiting to jump down and tackle me while I'm trying to cross the street.
No, I'm sure it isn't, definitely not. And right. I could tell you some funny stories here of the laws that we've got in place that means you can't sit on a bench and have a drink, but you can stand up and have a drink because right. COVID is going to get you sitting down.
Right. Right. Yeah. And my thing is you can draw parallels with this with a lot of other things. It's like, is you're not following science, you're following political science. And you're not, you know, as soon as political bias gets into something, it destroys it, whether it's sports, whether it's, the entertainment industry, whether it's like, and for intelligence folks, we have to work with politics all the time. But as soon as we become political, we are worthless as an organization or as a career. That's the biggest problem. And the same thing happened to COVID. As soon as it became political, we ruined our response because of that.
Were you involved with any of the statistics, or did you look into any of the data that was going on?
Yes. Yeah, and that's part of this. I did a couple of webinars, and like I said, I wrote a couple of articles. Like, by looking at the data, just showing how you can take the same set of data and draw a completely fabricated set of analysis and warnings and things like that, but the data doesn't really back it up if you twist it in a certain way, and that's the whole. You know, that's part of the whole fake news. It's like, well, my facts are different than your facts. It's like, well, you're taking those same facts, but you're twisting them and drawing them into a model that makes no sense whatsoever.
Why do you think they're twisting it?
What's that?
Why do you think they're twisting it?
Because a lot of times we use a lot of like information or the news. We're not using it to draw our own conclusions. And I know the buzzword is we're not critically reading our own news sources. We're not critically evaluating, is this a no kidding source? Because what we're really doing is we're seeking out information that confirms the bias that we already have in place. And so if you've been, most of my friends or families or neighbors who are just so deathly afraid of COVID, I can tell that it's because they're listening to different news sources than I am. And I know the news sources that they're looking at and things like that.
It's the same here. You know, you turn on our television and you watch what I call the mass media, the normal media. And you listen to the statistics that they're putting out, which sound absolutely awful. And then actually, if you analyze those statistics, and look at what they're saying.
That's right, and that's the whole story of fake news. It became kind of a buzzword like 4 years ago, but really when I started breaking it down, all fake news is propaganda that has slipped beyond. You know, in World War II, we had propaganda. We had, you know, and propaganda is government or government originated. News and stories to help influence the decision making of your adversary. And that's what, and really also the decision making of your own people to say that everything's going great. But now fake news is propaganda that is exercised by a political organization or a news organization, which now is, again, blurring past the point of what's a political organization. And, you know, it's news organizations are political organizations now, as they start embracing opinion-based news, or instead of providing, you know, a factual set of stories and let the viewers decide. Opinion-based news feels that, well, we're smarter than everyone else. We're going to tell you what to think, not what the actual stories are, and let you make your own decisions.
And then on top of that, you've got social media and what's going on there.
Right.
Think social media has exacerbated the problem or opened up a different view?
Yes and no. I mean, there's more information out there, but there's more noise. And it depends on if you want to, it's your attitude on how you approach social media. If you're going there, and I know that the term was called doom scrolling, when you're just scrolling through looking for something that will get you upset, that's your problem. You're already part of that hatred culture, that you can't just disagree with somebody and just let that slide by. You have to do something about it. You know, our generation of folks, it's, you know, when you've identified something that you just don't want to be a part of, or something that you don't like, you walk away. Now it seems to be more incumbent upon us. If you don't like something, I got to make that illegal so that nobody can do that. And that's part of what's ruining. And social media gives you a platform for anybody without an editor to voice their opinion. And my wife hates it when I say this, but it gives a platform for you to air your stupidity to the rest of the world without anybody saying, are you sure you want to say that? You know, and in old times you could have a discussion and somebody's like, let me reword that. Well, social media is too late. You just put it out there. That's why I deleted my Twitter account a couple of months ago. It was great source of information on some cases, but it just seemed more and more of a platform for folks to broadcast their ignorance.
And what do you make of all this censorship at the moment as well?
I am 100% against it. Absolutely. And just, you know, it's like I wrote in one of my articles, was that censorship does not defeat the other side's argument that you disagree with. It just makes it move to a different market space. And so if you're going to delete somebody's Twitter account or put their face, put them in Facebook.
Yeah,
it's like that's not going to have them stop and go, wow, I was really wrong. I'm going to change my opinion because of that. What it's going to get them to work twice as hard to get their message out, whether it's right or wrong. It's what they believe in. You know, censorship does not causes more problems, and it is very high risk to whoever practices it.
Absolutely. I mean, without making sort of any judgments or opinions, you know, what we're finding here in the UK, or what I'm looking at, is anybody that is sort of anti-vax, if I dare say it, is going down.
Right.
You know, they're being taken down from YouTube, taken down from Facebook. Right. I don't know I'm sure it's the same there.
Right. Yeah, it is. It's the cancel culture. We've gotten to such to the point of it's just absolutely ridiculous. And my wife is a librarian in a school, and we're actually in Loudoun County, Virginia, which is one of the first counties that has decided to take Dr. Seuss. And they used to have a Dr. Seuss Day, and they opened that up because they said they wanted a more diverse set of authors for children's authors. So they canceled Dr. Seuss Day, and they're calling it something else. Dr. Seuss is still included, but that kind of started that's all it needed to take was to start this touch point fire for the publisher now to come out and say, well, we're not going to publish six of the books. And now Universal Studios theme park in Orlando, they are now reviewing parts of their theme park to see if there are parts of Dr. Seuss that they want to eliminate from there. You know, that was a story out this morning. It's just, we've gotten to the point where it's just, how far do we have to go so that no one is offended, so that we end up with a society that is so dull and boring and just, you know, to the point of ridiculous, I mean, golly, it's George Orwell rolling in his grave. He's on point. He's just 40 years late.
Absolutely crazy. And sort of looking at this whole COVID situation, how do you see anything? Do you see anything in the statistics? Are you involved in any analysis that?
No, I mean, I am looking at the best part and the best argument I can make is the great part about the US is we have 50 states and each state is a laboratory. And whether it's economics or in this case it's COVID or cultural or whatever. And we can, you know, you have states that are on complete lockdowns and you can see what's happened as a repercussion. We have one state, South Dakota, that never locked down, never closed, I think they worked some mask mandates, but they never disrupted their economy and they kept the lowest. They're now the state with the lowest unemployment in the US. Texas and Mississippi just came out, I think yesterday or the day before, and said, we are now opening up. There is no mask mandate. You can wear it if you want, but we'll leave it up to the individual. And now we're going to see, you know, let that go. Now let's see, you know, they have a belief in what their scientific evidence is. And let's see whether it works. And I know there's some very draconian kickback to that. It's like, you can't do that. You're playing with people's lives. It's like, every state has a right to set their own policy. You cannot dictate that from above. You know, there's no one size fits all from Texas versus Florida versus California versus New York. You know, that you have to take a different approach in each case. That's the part that I get into more in terms of instead of really getting nerdy with the numbers, it's seeing the application of them and seeing what the effects are of the based upon the decisions that are being made.
It is, you're right. It's an experiment, isn't it? It's like a big lab because you've got the states where you haven't got physical borders as such. It's just a,
right.
It's just a booster, right. You know, COVID, right. But COVID doesn't know, well, you'd assume right. COVID doesn't see the borders, right?
Well, we do that with our tax codes, how states affect the tax. They do it with what their priorities are for spending, whether they spend more on infrastructure or not. And I grew up in the state of Michigan, and the biggest complaint, and it has never gone away, is that the roads in Michigan are terrible. And I was just there for a funeral on Tuesday of a family friend. My brothers and I piled up in the truck and drove there. And you could tell when you got to this, you crossed the border from Ohio into the state of Michigan, because they had torn the sign down that said, "Welcome to Michigan," and the roads just went to pot like almost instantly. And it was just, you know, okay, we're in Michigan now, the car's starting to bump. So, and it's just, and again, it's just, how do you fix that? Well, it's a northern state. They have more problems with their roads than Florida would, but, you know, but then you have to plan for, you know, additional infrastructure to take care of that. Florida also doesn't have to invest in snowplows like Michigan does. Each state has to do things differently. And that's the experiment of each state.
Going back to sort of to your days of the sort of data mining analysis, etc., you were involved with another infamous case. DB Cooper. Now, I just read up about this. You'll have to tell me more. I found it fascinating, and I believe you're involved in a potential Netflix project on it as well.
Right. I started this project. Out of the Able Danger hearings and the notoriety, I was contacted by an investigative reporter and a producer that working out of Hollywood or LA, who was working on several different projects, and he really wanted my insight on data mining and analysis and looking at it from a law enforcement perspective. And it wasn't until years later we've kept in touch. I kind of did some pro bono work, but in 2011, he called me up and just said, "Hey, I got a case. I was working on an investigation on a heroin triangle, drug triangle between Seattle, Las Vegas, and LA. And in the process, I had somebody identify and said, I know who DB Cooper is. It's this guy over here." And he goes, I want to know do you want to get on this project and use some of your expertise on that? And I'd been friends with him a couple of years already. He says, absolutely, you know, count me in. And the more we got into it, well, first we found out there's the guy that we thought was DB Cooper at the beginning was not the guy. It was a different guy, but he was his friend.
D.B. Cooper, because people here may not have heard.
Okay, yeah, that's right. D.B. Cooper is kind of a folk lore or a folk hero in American, and it's he was a disgruntled American who hijacked an airline in Seattle on November 24th of 1971, and he had the aircraft divert to Portland, Oregon. He had the authorities give him $250,000 and two parachutes. Why do you ask for two parachutes? Because if you ask for one, they're going to give you a bad one. If you ask for two, you could put the bad one on a flight attendant, yeah, and you're risking somebody on the aircraft. He had picked an aircraft that the stairs to going into the aircraft actually lowered from the back of the aircraft. So while he gave them instructions now to fly to, I think it was Mexico City or out of country. And in the flight over Northern California, again at night, he forced the flight crew up. All the passengers were already let off, but he forced the flight crew up to the front of the aircraft, lowered the back, and jumped. And nobody has seen him since. And it's the only unsolved case in our Federal Aviation Administration history.
Nobody found a body.
No body, but it was years later they found a portion of the cache was hidden in was dug up on a riverbank, and we now know that we now believe that the family that found it was actually set up, and they were told to find it just to throw authorities off, because it was not enough money to cover all the cash. It was just a small piece of it, and it had been there for several years, and yet all the rubber bands around the cash were brand new.
Oh wow. Okay.
So there was some specific pieces. And so as we started delving more and more into this individual, the individual that was identified, we ended up with, I think, 1,800 pieces of evidence. We ended up with DNA. I got involved with, because the lead investigator, a friend of mine named Tom Colbert, he had like a 70-page dossier that he was trying to get different law enforcement authorities to read it. And nobody was reading it. And so he gave it to me, and I gave it to one of my instructors who did a link analysis. I was running a training program at the time. And we created a chart, a link chart, based upon all the information that we had. And it was one visualization that showed this guy as the center and all of the things that he had been doing his entire life. And it was one grifting operation after another.
Do we know if he's harmed? I mean, up until that point, I mean, he was seen on the plane, right? And people saw him on the plane, I guess. And
right.
Describe right. him. Had he hurt anybody or?
No, that's again, it's one of the reasons why it was tough to get the FBI to pay attention to what we were doing. Is the same group within the bureau and I think it was the Seattle field office, the same group that was handling cold cases was the same group that was handling missing and exploited children. What's your priority? A child who had been missing for 2 weeks, or some old fart 50 years ago who hijacked an aircraft but didn't kill anybody and only stole $250,000? Yeah. So that's kind of what we were working towards. As we started again, and it was a combination of our own analysis using some modern data mining tools with old fashioned gumshoe investigative work. We've now finally gotten to the point where we're working on a Netflix show for it. And hopefully we'll be, I'm positive we'll be able to, tell the whole story. There's actually some details I don't want to discuss because they'll come out during the series. But
do we know when it's going to be aired? Is it this year?
Or well, we're trying to make the 50th anniversary of The Jump, which is November 24th. But I'm not sure we're going to make that. But it'll probably be next winter or things, something along that lines. But in the process of doing that one case, we are now on three additional cases that folks have just came to us and presented us with a potential solution to. And they're just as notorious or more notorious than that one. So we've been working with a smaller subset of the 40 some folks that we had involved in D.B. Cooper. We're now a handful of us that are doing that. And it's gotten so popular to the point that my university, I'm in the process of creating a cold case fraternity or cold case group within our university, because as an online school, the average age of our student is 32. So we have police investigators, we have cops, we have you know, analysts and, you know, soldiers and military members who are, you know, who work investigations. And what a fantastic thing is to be able to do that and try a crowdsourcing technique to solve some of these crimes. And that, you know, in the US alone, there's something along the lines of 1800 unsolved murders or cold cases, and more added every year. And so that's, you know, if you can create several teams of folks that can do that, what a fantastic way of crowdsourcing and using modern techniques to solve some of these cases.
How many times do you get it wrong, or does the tech, not you personally, but does the analysis get it wrong? Because obviously it's great if you get the right person. And
yeah.
But is there some statistics
behind,
you know, the good old fashioned way, and then obviously the technology that you're using?
Right. It's a lot. And that's part of when I wrote a book last year on intelligence operations, and part of the reasons why to combat getting it wrong is that every intelligence operation has to be a perfect combination of the data you bring in, the tools that you use, the people, honestly, the skill sets of the people that you have, and the processes that you use. And that becomes, you know, that becomes a big piece. A lot of organizations, especially after 9/11, was like, well, we're going to create an intel analysis cell, or they didn't call it intelligence, or, you know, and all they did was really, we're going to take a bunch of data, we're going to take a bunch of data mining tools, and we're going to throw it into this room with servers and everything, and now we have an intelligence function. And they forget about, you have to have people with the right skill sets.
They have the department. You discovered it, you found it, and they still ignored it. They still wanted you to dump it.
Right. So
doesn't it come to, in the end of the day, if your stats or if the computer or with your data doesn't match up with whoever's in that governing position, doesn't like the sound of it or doesn't know?
Right. Well, that the biggest part about and the folks that cause problems in intelligence are folks that lose sight that the whole reason we exist is to support somebody else. You know, intelligence is there to support a customer, a decision maker, somebody who does not have the time or the capability themselves to understand all the things about their threat or their competitors. And, you know, and I expand the term threat to, you know, the opposing, if you're, you know, in pro sports, the opposing team. There is somebody who watches videos on the opposing team to see their plays, who's injured, who's not, who's having contractual problems. All of those factor in how they're going to play the game next. So that's what I mean by it takes a lot more that, you know, you have to classify a threat as something other than a deadly national security threat. A threat could be just a threat to your livelihood as a company, your competitors or something like that.
I mean, people talk about, in fact, I'm going to ask you what we talked a little bit about this, what you think the biggest threat that the US faces today. And I know you mentioned cyber. Is there anything else that?
I take it from two perspectives.
Of course, you don't think it's COVID? Just to
No. I don't. It's that threat is we're doing.
I'm not
that
being flippant, obviously, if anyone listening who has had people that have
I still look at what there's a term called asymmetric threats, and it's really threats that do not come from, you know, a national threat or something like that. I still think our same strategic and competitors in the world, whether it's China or Iran, Russia in some cases, you know, those are still a threat to our national security. They will always be. There's no way around that. We can have partnerships with them. We can have strategic relations with them. But, you know, we always have to be, you know, vigilant toward that. From a intelligence standpoint, just because the Cold War is over does not mean the spying has not stopped. In fact, it has ramped up. And there's for crying out loud, I go to conferences now where the focus of the conference is how companies are spying on other companies. You know, and that's, you know, intelligence has gone way beyond national security, and it's filtered into every aspect of our lives with a
company spying on us as well.
What's that? Think about Think about all the invasions of privacy that are now coming out about.
I've got an Alexa who you know, she chirps up now and again, and I'm like,
right.
Who said that? Why are you?
Right.
It does scare me. It's like Big Brother's watching.
Right, absolutely. And that's like, it dawned on me when I was I was working with Norton Antivirus and some folks who make Symantec and the parent company. And they were talking about how they double their shifts at one point of the day during the weekday because the amount of cyber attacks doubles during that time. And it's just, and I use this as a point for teaching when I do get a chance to get in the classroom. And I always ask the students, so when are US networks most vulnerable to attack during the week? And the answer is always, well, it's gotta be the weekend, Friday night, Saturday, early in the mornings. It's 12 to 3 in the afternoons on the weekdays. Because most of the attacks and occur from script kiddies who are home from school and their parents are at work.
Wow.
And that's when they used to double their shift. Now COVID has probably thrown that model totally out the window.
Yeah, because we're home from schooling.
Right. And so when you have a limited amount of resources to put that's why you rely upon the intelligence folks to say, you know, here's some patterns that we see for these attacks, you know, and if we were able to figure some things out when we were doing some cyber network defense about what types of targets were the kids going for versus a national threat or a foreign intelligence service. And so we saw like the Army's medical networks were under attack during one portion of my time there. We immediately knew that was a foreign adversary. But when we saw all these attempted intrusions and we saw all this discussion, the number one target for a 17 to 21 year old to break into a DOD, a US Department of Defense network is Area 51, is to find out information about aliens that supposedly we got buried in the deserts out in, you know, That was their main focus, is trying to get in and find that information because they dang sure knew we were hiding it.
I'm going to have to ask, do you have any information on that?
No. You know, and I say no. And if I did, I'd say no.
Oh.
But that became a focal point. In fact, I remember we were looking at setting, our defense guys were like, you know, we know these kids are coming here. Let's set up a fake site. And just have them go to some fake site that'll keep them happy, and then they'll stay away from the rest of the network. It was a fishbowl operation.
I'm dying to ask if we've got bunkers somewhere in case the human race amount of people have to survive an apocalypse or a meteor or an invasion.
You got to get more fiction writers on your show to answer that. So.
Eric, look, on a more serious note, do you see what we've talked about, threats to the US? And I guess I don't just mean the US, because I think it's a global thing.
Right.
Why do you do what you do? What do you love about it?
I always have that. There's always a patriotic foundation to that. But I just love doing analysis. I got into wargaming as a 8-year-old and doing historical wargaming with my brothers and families and things like that. The type of analysis that had to go in that was very similar. And so when I was an intelligence officer for an armor brigade and an infantry battalion in Germany in the mid 90s. And after one of our exercises where we were deployed, we had to sit down with the commander, and the commander sat down and he goes, I've never seen it like this before, but you do what you do very well. And he says, you're one of the few people that looks like you enjoy it. And I just said, sir, I've been playing war games since I was 8 years old. You're just paying me to do it now. That became that part. And so that goes from one part of my career to the next. Anything, it always had to do with analysis. And so I've actually shied away from, you know, staying out of the upper management, or, you know, wanting to be a CEO or a general officer or something like that. Because as you progress up that chain, you're doing more and more management of personnel and you're getting less and less away from what I know I'm good at.
Yeah.
And so that's, if I could show you down to the other end of my basement, I got a room with thousands of miniature figures that I've painted. I've got two game tables. They each cost $1,000 a piece because they're recessed with all the, you know, with USB ports on the side, and there's, you know, all kinds of board games. And there's a company out of UK, Games Workshop. I think I put some of their kids through college with the amount of money I've spent on that. My neighbors come down and look at this kind of stuff and just, and it's just like, how can you afford all that time and all that patience and money to do this? And I just look at them and say, well, I don't golf.
Yeah.
I never took up golf.
It's your value, it's your passion, it's your purpose, right? It's right. We've all got a gift, we've all got a
right. Purpose. Right. And that got me into writing my book last year. And now I'm getting into writing a fiction book based upon gaming. It's just, you know, these things now, as I get older and older, I start changing the things I want to do in my life. And, you know, that's one of them. But all of them are, you know, a tribute to my family and tribute to my father and my wife and two kids and that kind of thing. Those are always the most important pieces for me.
Eric, it really has been so interesting talking to you. And that's
thank you.
Pleasure.
Likewise.
I've just come to my last question because we're running out of time.
Okay.
And that is, if you were to write a message in a bottle for future generations to find, what would that message be?
I would only write, I hate having to sit down and think about these kind of things because your life gets so busy and you get overwhelmed from day to day. But I think that would be the thing, is never let yourself get overwhelmed from day to day. Focus on the things that, understand what is important to you in your life, and always keep those in focus. And to me, it's my God, my country, and my family. And everything you do will gear toward that.
Eric, thank you so much for being a guest on my show.
Hope you enjoyed the show. Remember, there's a new interview out every Monday. So hit subscribe and like, and you'll get it straight into your inbox.